This week's G8 summit comes at a time when all of the member countries face tough economic and political problems. Ian Bremmer, president of Eurasia Group, questioned what the G8 can accomplish in an article for foreignpolicy.com. He's also the author of the new book, Every Nation for Itself, Winners and Losers in a G0 World. We welcome Ian Bremmer to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
So glad to be with you.
Give us an idea of what a G0 world is.
Well, it's a world where we are certainly less prepared to provide global leadership, whether it's removing Bashar Assad from power in Syria or bailing out the Europeans or leading a global climate or trade initiative. And it's also one where countries around the world that are powerful are less prepared to go along with us when we do want to exercise that leadership. And it's radically different from the U.S.-led world of globalization that we've all experienced over past decades.
So you have this G8, this summit, these world leaders, the most powerful nations on Earth. What is missing from that equation to get something done?
Well, one, Putin, was a G8, and he decided he was going to stay at home, that creating a cabinet in an authoritarian state was more important than showing up. It's certainly true that the United States and the Europeans, the Japanese, share a lot of interests and values. Of course, they represent a much smaller piece of the world economy today than they used to. China is the world's second largest economy right now. Countries like Russia and India and Brazil and Turkey matter an awful lot more. And then the U.S. is more than willing to dispense lots of advice this weekend at the G8 summit to the Europeans on what they should do to get through the crisis. Geithner, Secretary of Treasury Geithner, has gotten on a lot of planes to get to Brussels and Berlin, but the Americans aren't writing any checks. I mean, this is very different from the U.S. response to the peso crisis or the ruble crisis, to say nothing of the notion of a Marshall Plan for the Europeans after World War II. I mean, those sorts of things aren't remotely feasible for any Democrat or Republican seeking office today, and aren't desirable for an American population that's wondering why we should do things like rebuild Afghanistan when we don't rebuild New Orleans after Katrina.
You write a lot about China in the book, and one of the points you make is that really China is quite distracted right now, aren't they?
They are very distracted. They are the world's second largest economy. They will become the first at some point in the next 5 to 20 years, depending on who you talk to economically. But they will still be a poor country, which means they're not going to provide the kind of money that is required to do the things that the U.S. has done historically, defend the seas and stop countries from developing nuclear weapons, or try to at least inhibit them from doing it, delay them, that sort of thing. The Chinese have to fundamentally restructure their economic system and at least some of their political system just to stay in power over the next 20 years. They're really not interested in taking the mantle of global leadership, even in part, from the United States. Oh, they'll pay a lot of attention to things in their neighborhood, the Philippines or Taiwan, that sort of thing. But even Afghanistan, Pakistan, I was talking to some Chinese leaders a few months ago and saying, well, look, you know, the Brits, the Soviets, now the United States have all kind of had their turn in Afghanistan. You guys next, right? And they laughed. They said, as my mother used to say, not no, but hell no. Not our problem.
Mm. You talk about how ultimately, and this is to me a sort of a no-brainer, but I have to ask you about it, which is that the Achilles heel here is unemployment. That's what can bring us down.
Well, in the United States, the Achilles heel is that you have an increasingly large percentage of the population that does not believe they benefit from the United States being the world's policeman, or the United States being the lender of last resort, or the United States providing economic support and benefits, supporting free trade globally, that sort of thing.
Are they right? Do they benefit?
Comes from higher unemployment. There's no question.
Yeah, are they right? Do they benefit?
Well, I mean, America benefits. There's no question. America benefits as a whole. But if you look at the gap between rich and poor in the United States, and you look at the sense of opportunity for Americans that don't have a college education, then it's a reasonable question to ask. I mean, over the last 40 years, there's been incredible globalization. American corporations have done incredibly well. Shareholders in those corporations, who are overwhelmingly Americans, have done incredibly well. Americans living in major cities with proper education, advanced education, have done incredibly well. But increasingly, a very large part of the United States doesn't benefit from the American dream. And those are people that will say, why are we supporting globalization? Let's have subsidies at home. Ultimately, that's a real problem for the U.S. If we don't get that problem right, you know, you can kiss goodbye long-term the notion of the U.S. Being a benevolent superpower more broadly.
The title of the book is Every Nation for Itself. What about the United Nations and their role? What happened? Why are they not more apparent in this equation of trying to bring these nations together?
Well, the Security Council in many ways was a precursor of the problem we now have with the G20, which is, you know, the world's 20 largest economies that all in principle are supposed to be meeting and helping to respond to global challenges. And number one, it's because there are too many of them. So, you know, whenever you hear about these meetings from the envoys that go, you always say it's like herding cats. But with the Security Council in the United Nations, it's even worse, because not just herding lots of cats, which would be hard, it's herding cats and animals that don't like cats. And that is not really herding, right? In Security Council, you have countries like China and Russia. They are authoritarian states. The U.S. is a democracy, and American allies are. They are state capitalist economies. The state is the largest actor in their economies. The U.S., the Europeans are free market economies. They're fundamentally poor countries. The U.S. and their allies are fundamentally rich countries. I mean, you create enough of these differences, and you realize that the perspectives of these countries sitting around the table are just profoundly different on every major issue, whether it's human rights or trade or currency and monetary policy or climate. And you know, you add enough of those up and you say, well, how are you going to get anything done in that group? For decades, we've had a world where the United States led global institutions, and that's really gone. And going forward, it'll either be a world where the United States leads institutions that aren't global, they'll be smaller, but they'll be like-minded, or there'll be more global institutions that aren't U.S.-led. And we really do have to decide which of those two we prefer.
The name of the book is Every Nation for Itself, Winners and Losers in a G0 World. Ian Bremmer, great pleasure to have you on our program. I thank
Truly
you.
Truly a pleasure. Enjoyed it.
Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.